Today, we're going to be talking about the sixth week in this series called Be. And I don't know about you, but this is one of those where we've journeyed through some scriptures that most of us have heard before, but God's really been doing something really unique. And if you've missed this journey, it's been really fantastic because we're looking at these sort of visionary statements that Jesus gave about 2,000 years ago. And with these visionary statements, he painted a picture of what the life of those who followed him would look like. And so we've kind of unpacked that over the last 6 weeks. And if you've missed, I want to encourage you to go to our website and download the podcast or go out into the lobby and get the CD and go back through these because there's a lot of richness there. And I think God wants to do something fantastic. We're looking now at the last two Beatitudes today, and we're going to jump right into Matthew chapter 5, where we've been the last 6 weeks. Today we're going to look at verses 9 and 10. And let's just jump right into Matthew 5, verse 9. And it says this, Jesus talking, "Blessed are the peacemakers, for they will be called the sons of God." What do you think of when you hear the word peacemaker? Chances are you get an idea in your mind of a person that you know that seems to bring peace to situations. Maybe it's your middle child who negotiates and brokers peace between the youngest and the oldest, or between the kids and the parents, or whatever that might be. Maybe it was a friend at school that was good at coming in the middle of a crowd and sort of bringing peace. Or maybe your life's not really been filled with peace. We all have different ideas of what that looks like, and especially when we throw out the idea of the word peace itself, we all have a different idea of what peace really looks like, don't we? And for some of us, it's sort of, peace is something we think of in big, grandiose terms, you know, like, well, I believe there should be world peace, right? I believe that there should be peace between those countries. Or we look at the conflict, ongoing conflict between Israel and Palestine, and we think, oh man, those countries need peace. Or, you know, we also think about it sometimes in sort of flowery, utopic ways. And you know, we look at the decade of the 60s and the decade of the 70s. There was a real movement for peace, right? Anybody was at Woodstock in those days? Ever heard of Woodstock? Ever heard of the 60s? Are you alive? Anyone breathing at this point? Thank you. I got one hand over here, and everyone else is dead. So I definitely see dead people. Anyway, you know, it's easy to kind of look at peace like that. It's sort of like, you know, the unicorns are flying and the flower child and, you know, peace, peace, peace. Or we can go on the other end of the spectrum and look at it in like really small ways. Like we think, well, peace is that rare moment when our kids aren't screaming and yelling at each other. Or we think, if I could just have a few moments of peace and quiet. You ever wish for that? Or, oh man, this lake is peaceful, or that music is peaceful, or that painting is peaceful. Whatever it is, a lot of us have a different idea of what peace is all about. When we look in the scriptures, Jesus is talking about peacemaking. And the scriptures are clear that we should be a people of peace. And Psalm 34 tells us that we should turn away from evil and do good, to seek peace and pursue it. But what is it? What does Jesus have in mind when he's talking about blessed are the peacemakers? Well, I want to look at what the verb for peacemaking really means in the scriptures here. When we unpack what he's talking about, it's simply this, to endeavor to reconcile. It's like a mission of reconciliation. And what is reconciliation? It's putting things back together. It's reuniting. It's restoring. And so the idea of peacemaking is simply this. A peacemaker is someone who works to put something back together, to bring restoration. And I think if we're honest, we can all look around and we can see people and situations and opportunities where restoration can happen because people are hurting and broken and in need of peacemaking. And when Jesus brought this up, this wasn't the first time that the concept of peace really ever came up. Throughout the Old Testament, the Hebrew word shalom was used. Would you say that with me? Shalom. Now look at your neighbor and say it to them. Shalom. Okay? That's like saying peace, sort of. That was always translated into the word peace. But it wasn't just this little flower child fairy tale moment that shalom was talking about. It was a very real concept. And here's what shalom really means. Shalom sort of indicates completeness and wholeness in every area of life, including one's relationship to God, neighbors, and nations. Remember the scene on Jerry Maguire where Jerry's in the elevator and the one girl is with her boyfriend and she signs to him. And what is it that she signs to him? You. complete me. You complete me. You guys are asleep. There's something in that I think we all recognize because we see this element of completion there. That's beautiful. When two people who love one another come together, there's this element of completion, of wholeness. Wouldn't it be great if all of our life was like that? Mine's definitely not. I know those people who seem to live in sort of like a constant state of zen, and like the whole world could be crumbling around them, but they're just, everything is great, you know? You know, and they're either drinking Xanax or they just have got to this place where they're feeling like life is perfect. But for me, like, I feel like life is always like dodging the next thing. It's like, oh God, here it comes, and life happens to me. I don't always have every piece of my life put together. There are people that do that. But Shalom is talking about that. It's talking about completeness, taking the broken pieces and put back together. And notice that it starts from the inside and works its way out. It starts with having sort of a connection with God, one's relationship with God, and then it moves to one's relationship with our neighbors, and ultimately one's relationship with the nations. So here's the thing. If you're the type of person that likes the formulas, what I mean is like the recipe, you know, like, okay, enough philosophical mumbo-jumbo. Just give me the 5 steps to peacemaking so I can execute it this week. I'm going to give you the 5 steps to peacemaking right now. All you have to do is work toward bringing about a sense of completeness and wholeness, okay? That's sort of what you're doing, and here's where you do it. In your own life, in the lives of other people, and everyone in the entire world. Go do that, and you'll be a peacemaker. Let's pray. That sounds kind of tough, doesn't it? Is it just me, or does that seem a little bit overwhelming? How many people do you know in life who their life is a train wreck? It seems like they're always chasing everything that they can do to find inner peace. Or how often do we hear of neighbors arguing with one another, bickering over things, or suing one another? Or when we turn on the evening news and we see nations on the news pitting one against another, do we see that on a regular basis? Yes, we do, because that's the world that we live in. And the problem with the idea of peacemaking is sometimes it can seem overwhelming because there's so much that needs work and we just don't end up doing anything at all. We live in this tension, and I think there's a reason why we live in this tension. I think all of humanity lives in a tension that the Beatitudes speak to. And I think what's cool is the Beatitudes give us a way to be in the world and to reduce that tension, but the tension exists. And I think the real reason why this tension among us, each other, and our inside selves, and with our neighbors, and with the nations, is simply this, that we all have a sense of feeling incomplete in our lives. I don't care how much you parade around and pretend like you have it together. We all feel like something's missing, don't we? We all of us feel like we're not quite locked into that thing. And I think the reason is explained by the gospel. And remember the essence of the gospel. We did a series about it a couple years ago. I'm going to go through it really quickly to help us understand what peacemaking is all about. The gospel begins with what? Creation. God creates all things. He puts things in order. And then in Genesis 1:27, it says, God says, let us make man in our own image. So God creates humanity. And on the inside of all humans, he puts his thumbprint, his DNA. He said, you're like me. Here's what you're like. In Genesis chapter 2, we see Adam and Eve take the plunge for all of humanity and thrust us into a wild, wild season where we've experienced the fall. And it was like a piece of their nature, which led to a piece of our nature, had been ripped out. That completeness, that shalom that God had created had been torn apart. And from that day on, we've all suffered from a sense of incompleteness. Unfortunately, that's not the end of the story. Jesus came 2,000 years ago and lived a life to bring us back to this place of redemption, meaning that we could be made right with God, that no longer did God seemingly have his back turned toward us, but he made a way so that we could have relationship with him. And then there's this final part, restoration, which is restoring all things to God. Because you see, it was never God's intention that through the cross, the only thing that was going to happen is that we'd be made right with him, but everything was going to remain broken. Restoration was a part of the journey. And we talk a lot about this as a community here at the Orchard. We talk about restoration. And the reason we do is because we don't believe that restoration is something that we simply just put in a box and say, someday Jesus is going to come back on a white horse and he's going to speak and everything will be made whole. We do believe that Jesus will return. But we believe that the tension that we live in right now is something that's good for us because it pushes us to begin the process of restoration now, that God's already in the business of restoring people's lives and their hearts and restoring families and neighborhoods and cities and nations. And so we feel like we're going to be a part of that. And I think that's exactly what Jesus is talking about when he said, blessed are the peacemakers. I believe that God wants to use his people, that's you and that's me, to bring a sense of shalom, completeness, put things back together. Because peacemakers are actively working to bring out the best in all situations. Remember how shalom starts with the inside moving out. I think peacemakers look at other people and they speak to that part that they might not even realize is in there, that part that says that the imprint of God, God's DNA is on the inside. And if you've never heard that before, let me just look at you and tell you, the imprint of God is on your heart. It's on your person, that you bear the image of God. And even if you say, I'm not a follower of Jesus today, there's an imprint on your soul. And when we start speaking to that part of you that was created by God and said there's a likeness to God's image, and helping people to connect with the fact that they could bring something of substance and something good to this world, it's like a homing beacon comes and opens up and the satellite starts radioing home, and God has an opportunity to start speaking to them and doing something really amazing in their life. And God uses us as peacemakers to bring shalom to people on the inside. I think God also uses peacemakers to work in neighborhoods. And you remember a few weeks ago, we had Tony and Laura Burton up here on the stage. And Tony and Laura had decided to move to an area in East Aurora that's a pretty rough area. It's not a place that we would look at and go, well, that's a peaceful place. You know, let me go vacation in peaceful this part of East Aurora where there's violence and there's drugs and there are all these things sort of happening. You know, Tony and Laura, they weren't stopped by that. They didn't accept the status quo that it's always going to be like that, because they're taking very seriously this idea of bringing shalom to a neighborhood. And I believe because they're there and because they're loving people and they're establishing relationships and they're speaking into the hearts and lives of people, that they will become peacemakers there. And God's going to do something really fantastic through that neighborhood. And finally, I think peacemakers work to reconcile people with one another. And they say basically it's not enough to hate each other because we look different or we have a different background or we have a different belief system or we don't live in the same neighborhood. Peacemakers seek to break down walls and overcome hostility and bring healing. And the tough thing about that is that gets hard sometimes. When you seek to be a peacemaker and to break down walls, sometimes you have to, in order to build bridges between different groups of people, you have to sort of stand in the gap and put yourself in vulnerable positions and in places that might seem just a little bit uncomfortable. That's the role of a peacemaker, is someone who said, I'm willing to take the darts. I'm willing to step into a discomfort so that I can help other people on their journey and I can extend compassion in the hands and feet of Christ to other people. Every year in Chicago, there is a parade. It's the Gay Pride Parade. You might have seen it on TV or heard of it. And it really is irritating to me how the Christian community has showed up at events like this and connected with the gay community in a way that I don't think reflects the way that all Christians feel. Because they come with these signs and post hateful messages and basically speak and say, God's through with you, you're worthless, you're no good, God doesn't want to do anything with you. And it really bothers me, because I don't think that represents who Jesus intended us to be. That's not being, that's being hateful. And it's alarming to me how many of us as Christians, and I can say this because I am one, that isn't it true that often we work at sowing seeds of division and not working at the ministry of reconciliation? I'm going to tell you about a real-life peacemaker who lives in this area. His name is Ryan, and some of you may know Ryan. Ryan is the director of an organization in Aurora called Hesed House, who has a phenomenal outreach to homeless people. And Ryan is a really interesting guy. He's a really smart guy. Ryan's an attorney. He's a follower of Jesus. He's a husband and a family man. But more importantly, I think Ryan is a peacemaker. So a few weeks ago, the Gay Pride Parade happened in Chicago. Ryan went down to the Gay Pride Parade, and he made a sign. And his sign looked a lot different than the other Christians that were at this thing. And I want to show you a picture of Ryan standing in this parade. Well, look at some of those signs there. I still don't get the threat to national security. I don't really understand that. These are people who are holding up Bible verses, though, and condemning people that we have largely alienated from the church. We've not worked to understand or to extend love, whether we agree or disagree with how they live their life. And it's easy as Christians to sit and throw stones. And so we see people with big boulders in their hands that says, God hates you, and turn or burn. Ryan had the boldness to stand in the midst of those same people. And I think that it's there's a beautiful picture there of how that sort of barricade, he's in front of that barricade holding that sign. And all it says is free hugs. Isn't that a different message than all the ones around it? Good for Ryan. If you look closely at Ryan's shirt, it said, God loves you. I think that's the message of a peacemaker. And as a role of peacemakers, for us to stop looking at people with judgment and with hate and with seeds of division, but of reconciliation and reminding people that though we're all broken and cracked, and that our story is all part of that gospel story, that restoration is a big part of what God wants to do. And I think that's the ministry of a peacemaker. And I'm going to ask Ben and Jamie to come on up, and I want to kind of dive into this just a little bit and talk about what a peacemaker actually does. And Ben, let me just ask you, how is it that people become peacemakers? It seems like, you know, such a daunting task, and we see that Ryan did that. What are some ways that people can take it upon themselves to take steps forward on this journey?
You know, I kind of think it's not something that happens quick. It's not something that happens overnight. And the idea of making peace has a lot to do with the word making. I mean, it's a verb, right? Peacemakers. It's something, it's an action. It's something you're going out and doing. And so peacemaking, we can never expect that it's going to be something that just happens. It has to take, there has to be an action moving toward that. Let me tell you this quick story about my wife, her grandmother, her paternal grandmother. So that means her dad's mom. Wow. Right? Yeah, dad's mom. Her dad's mom. She lives in California, sweet woman, and she, several years ago, she lost her husband. Her husband passed away. Right around that time, she kind of went inward. She got depressed, and she also started like rehashing a lot of stuff that had been said about the family, about her and about her husband, holding on to all these hostilities against other family members. And so she isolated herself. She really withdrew. She isolated herself. She was really depressed. She didn't speak to anybody in the family for years. Now, in fact, it wasn't until 7 or 8 years into our marriage that I even met this woman, my wife's grandmother. And in the middle of that, though, God started working in her. And started working in her through some people. She got involved with this church in California. She started listening to God and getting humble before God, and confessing to God, and doing this hard inner work herself. And after a period of time, she actually started reaching out. She started making amends. She started making peace. And part of that peacemaking had to do with setting aside her own ego, walking away from the ego that's always telling us that we're the ones that are right and righteous, right? And she had to say and come out with this posture of saying, you know what? I'm sorry, I might be wrong. I might have been wrong about the past. It didn't fix everything overnight. It didn't make it so that those things didn't happen, all the previous hurts and things that were said. But it did change. What happened is her heart was changed. And she developed this attitude that said, I might be wrong, but this. That's the attitude of a peacemaker. One that says, well, I don't know. I might be wrong, but it's a different posture. But it came from her doing the inner work first. You know, I really think to become a peacemaker, you got to do the inner work. You got to have peace within first. You have to start and heal inside first. It took time.
That's kind of heavy.
I know it's heavy. It's hard.
It's hard work.
Yeah.
Jamie, I think you were sharing a story with us. I think peacemaking, you know, it starts within, and sometimes we have to take a step. And you were telling us a story of someone, even within our own community,
who
took some steps recently.
A few weeks ago, a father, he's a father, husband, came in one of the prayer times that we had, and he came and he was just broken and in tears, and he asked for prayer. And before we asked for prayer, I asked him to share his story a little bit, what's going on. And he said God was wrestling with him to have inner peace, and he wasn't having it. There was something in his life that he said was stopping him, and it was affecting his life. And we started kind of talking a little bit before we prayed. We started talking about the process of usually what God will do is God will start, you know, in order to give you that inner peace, he'll start leading you on a journey of healing in those areas where you've been wounded in your life. And he started talking about that, and he said, you know, in 25 years, he hasn't talked to his father. In 25 years, not one word. He had kids since then, married, not one word, had want nothing to do with them because his father had hurt him and wounded him. And he just said, I picked up, and to be the initiator, he picked up and he called him. And he started this journey with his dad on this area of forgiveness and reconciliation and peacemaking. And he took the initiative of the peacemaker. And he says, it's a long journey. And we start talking about what this is going to do for his sons and his daughter. For him to be able to take that initiative and to be a peacemaker and start the journey. It isn't all fun and games right off the bat, but just started the journey with his father. Started to reconnect and talk. But what that's going to do, not just for him, but the peace he's giving to the next generation. Mm. And that's why he can boldly proclaim, blessed are the peacemakers, for they will be called sons and daughters of God.
Yeah,
that's good. What I love about that story is that's just an average, ordinary person, not a superhero or superstar. It's someone who just said, I take this upon myself to take steps forward.
That's right.
Yeah. Ben, why don't we go and dive into the next, the big grand finale, the beautiful finale. Ending, the fun ending of the Beatitudes.
Right. Those of you who know what it is are chuckling. So we've been on this series, talking about the Beatitudes, walking with Jesus through these kind of revolutionary statements. And what you've noticed and what we talked about every time is how they really connect with one another, how one builds off another. And these two that we're doing today really work hand in hand. I almost feel like Jesus said these in like the same breath about blessed are the peacemakers, and then this next one. And this next one, it's really the climax of the whole thing. It's what Jesus kind of builds toward. It's like, you've been on this journey the whole time now. What is the climax? So you're wondering, what is it? Is it a great reward? Is it, you know, is it fame? Is it wealth? Is it, you know, eternal happiness? Well, let's read it. Let's read it together. Ready? It's on the screen. Let's read it together. Blessed are those who are persecuted because of righteousness, for theirs is the kingdom of heaven. Wah, wah, wah. Right? And then Jesus continues on. He caps it off with these two verses after this. He says, blessed are you when people insult you and persecute you and falsely say all kinds of evil against you because of me. Rejoice and be glad, because great is your reward in heaven. For in the same way they persecuted the prophets who were before you. And this is really it. This is the climax. This is the pinnacle of these statements. And it's really the only beatitude that Jesus spends more than like one sentence talking about, right? It's the only of these statements that he expounds upon, and I think he does it for a reason. I think he does it because he really, really wants it to sink into his followers, how crucial this is, this idea of expecting persecution. And I think it works. I think it works. Because if you listen and you follow the lives of a lot of the disciples that were sitting there at that time, and many of them ended up in the end of the game. They ended up losing their lives to this call to follow Jesus. They took it to heart and lived it out. And I think if we are honest together and we look at all these statements, I think if we're honest, we realize that that is probably the hardest one for us to get excited about. Hmm. Right? I could spin some of these other ones to attract a bunch of people and, you know, it could be exciting, but this, and man, it's not sexy, it's not fun, it's not probably the thing we're gonna, hey, let's throw it up on a big billboard and like we're gonna get a lot of Christians to come hang out and talk about how we are persecuted. Hey, come join our church so we can get persecuted together. And I think, obviously, part of the reason why we're so, it's a hard one to get our minds around, is most of us are so wrapped up in this quest for contentment that we would rather value security and comfort over living a good story in life, over living out a good story. And I think that's what Jesus is asking us to do here. I think we're constantly seeking to medicate ourselves. We're constantly seeking to avoid pain, insulate ourselves from anything that causes even a little bit of discomfort, let alone anything that might resemble persecution. Ultimately, Jesus invites us to live out here and to live a meaningful story in life. That's it. Ultimately, what Jesus is inviting us into is to live out a meaningful story. And a story that is meaningful is full of downfalls and full of redemption, and it's full of pain and loss and recovery from that pain and from that loss, but has to go through that period of experiencing that pain. And a good story brings hope and healing into the world, into the broken world around us. And it's that kind of hope that has to cost something. Bringing peace, being a real peacemaker, living this way, living with this completely different lens and living a different set of actions, it costs something. It has to cost something. Have you ever seen a movie or read a book where there's no conflict? If you have, you probably can't even remember it right now because it was probably a lousy movie or a lousy book, right? That's just because it's hardwired in us. We want that. There's something in us as human beings that we long for a good story, right? We long to be able to see pain redeemed. Like, that's just how we're built. That's what we're wired for. You know, nobody wants to go see a movie about a baseball team who goes undefeated all season and faces no adversities on their way to the top and on the way to win the championship, right? We want to see the Bad News Bears or something, right? We get... there's something in us that longs for that. But I think a lot of us have bought into the lie that our lives are meant, are wired to be able to be comfortable, and that our happiness is going to be found sitting back in front of the television with our feet propped up, accumulating more stuff and a bigger house and a bigger retirement fund and a bigger bag of potato chips to dip our hand into and eat of. And that is where we're going to find our true happiness, is isolation, insulation from the comfort, medication from any kind of pain. And the problem with living that way and the problem with seeking after life that way, and if that's our end goal, that's fine. But listen, the problem with it is that there's no skin in the game of yours. You've got no purpose, no meaning, you've got nothing on the line. So Jesus invites us to this different kind of living. Instead of living, just trying to seek anything to numb the pain, to live with our eyes wide open. Being persecuted for righteousness is simply a call for us to bring hope and healing and peace to the world in front of us, and it costs something. So, as American Christians, though, I think that there's often a couple different reactions that you and I typically tend to have to this kind of thing, to this statement of blessed are the persecuted. One, and I've had this reaction, I've heard a lot of people have this reaction. One, it's not about us. It's that one's about other people. It's about people in China who aren't allowed to carry Bibles, or it's about people who are in Indonesia and have their churches shut down by the government. That's persecution. It's not about us. You know, we're Americans. You know, we've earned our freedom. We're beyond that. We live. You know, we've evolved past that, and so that's not about us. So we don't have to worry about that. I think the problem with understanding it this way, though, is it's a completely ignoring the heart of the Beatitudes that we've been diving into for these weeks. Remember, these are not statements of condolence, but these are revolutionary statements that call for a different kind of lifestyle. And what Jesus is saying in here, again, is that this kind of lifestyle, if you live this way, it costs something. It has to. I think the other reaction that we as American Christians tend to have to this statement is to say something like, yep, I am persecuted. Man, that stinks. But I am persecuted. Every time I talk about my faith in the office, I get persecuted. Every time I tell people about how immoral they are, every time I tell them about what wrong ways they're living life, I suffer. I get made fun of. I get shunned. I get shut out. I get persecuted. And if that's you, if you've had that thought, a lot of us have had that thought, I ask you to do one thing. I have to just stop. And before we go into like too much of a pity party for ourselves, stop and reread that scripture carefully. It says, blessed are those who are persecuted for righteousness' sake, not for self-righteousness' sake. You see, if you constantly are finding yourself in scenarios where you're always seen as the moral police, if you're constantly finding yourself in these confrontational, argumentative conversations about faith or life or anything where morals, where someone walks away the winner and someone walks away the loser, there's a chance that you may not be being persecuted for righteousness' sake. There's a chance. And I say that with that same heart of, you know what, like, I'm not sure. I don't have all the answers. I don't know for certain. But there's a chance that you might not be suffering because of righteousness, but self-righteousness, and because of an unchecked ego. How much our egos are caught up in this stuff. There's a chance that it might not be that you're suffering because of persecution, but simply, you're just acting like a jerk. And I'm serious about that. Yeah, it was funny. So when I was in college, I was a volunteer leader for Young Life. And we worked with high school students. And there was this one kid. He was a Christian kid. And he would come around to our stuff. And I got to know him a bit. And he loved to wear t-shirts like this. Right? You've seen these. And like this. Right? He loved these t-shirts. Nothing wrong with those. But that was him. And he would always find himself in these conversations with people at school about faith and about life and about morals and about, well, he would confront them on the way that they were living wrong, right? And all the bad things that they were harming themselves and people around them, and he would come down on them and tell them, and he would then come back to me and say, oh, Ben, I don't know, I'm always so persecuted. At school, I'm constantly I'm being ridiculed, I'm being shut out, I'm not being listened to. And he would get himself so worked up and so angry about these kids at school that would, quote unquote, that would persecute him. But the truth is that nobody wanted to be around this kid. Right? I didn't even want to be around this kid, right? But I feel like, oh, I gotta hang out with him. And I'll tell you what, like, I was young at the time, but and I didn't have the guts to say this to him, but I wish I had. I wish I had sat him down. I wish I would have said, dude, listen, nobody is going to listen to you because they are afraid they're going to get yelled at. I would have said, you know what, you're not building bridges to people. You're tearing them down. And you have to love on people first and care for them and build a relationship with them and get them to understand that you have a heart concern for them and a care for them way before you ever share any concerns like the kind of things that you're sharing about. You're not building bridges, you're burning them down. And so, you know, it's been several years and Larry's changed a lot since then. I know, you wouldn't know it, but...
yeah, well, come on.
We're making peace. Getting left
you know
out.
What, I'll show you some.
It's all right, brother. It's funny though, because we were talking about that. Seriously, we were talking about that this week. I was sharing that story.
Yes.
Jamie, come.
Oh.
Hey, I'm Jamie Johnson. Just kidding. No, we were talking about that this week, and Larry. Why don't you share a little bit of your story?
Yeah, you know, it's interesting because that was me. That kid was me for a little while. I mean, it might be hard for you to believe, but there was a season of my life that I wasn't the sweetest person. And I don't know why that's funny. and why my wife is laughing. But anyway, so, you know, when I was about 17 or 18, I had lived in such a kind of a crazy environment that I did kind of a hard turn toward God. And I think sometimes when we do that, it's easy to sort of, at least for me, it was easy to go in a sort of hyper-religious mode. Because I think God had done something very significant in my life. And so I started making a list of rules. You know, if I did this and said this and, you know, do all these things. And I also had a no list, you know, no rated R movies and no alcohol and no, you know, smoking and no listening to secular music or, you know, all these sorts of no's, no's, no's. And the problem was I looked at everyone around me and sort of made my no's their no's, you know. Have you ever done that before or know someone that's like that? I looked at everyone else and went, hey, you know, these are the standards that I've set before you. You must measure up to them. But the problem was I'm not Jesus, believe it or not. And so I enjoyed, like, arguing with people and calling people out and, like, pointing out their immorality and how they were wrong in this way and in that way. And I couldn't figure out why people didn't seem to really like that too much. And I had the Christian T-shirts, and I had all the right language. And it's interesting because when Annette and I got married, I even acted like that toward her at times. Mm-hmm. You know, I find myself calling her out and go, oh, I can't believe you're watching that or whatever, you know, or you listen to secular radio station today? Why didn't you listen to the Jesus channel? You know,
the Jesus channel.
And you know, I opted against divorce because she didn't like the Jesus channel, moved on. And a few years later, I started working at this church. And I met some of my coworkers. These guys, you know, they would have a beer or a glass of wine with dinner, and I just kind of, whoa, you know, like, you shouldn't be doing that, you know. I can remember being at one of their houses and offering me a cigar, you know, and I'm like, oh, you know, smoking won't send you to hell, but it'll make you smell like you've been there, you know. Oh, God, help me. These guys watch rated R movies, and they listen to, you know, satanic bands such as U2 and Coldplay. And, I mean, it was easy for me to call them out on it, but there was one problem in this. There was a glitch in sort of my formula, and that was I realized one day these guys loved Jesus more than I did. And, I get a lump on my throat saying that because it was very hard to reconcile the list of don't do this and don't do this and don't do this with someone who didn't follow all of those same rules but had a deep, abiding relationship with Jesus. And it made me realize that what I had taken as persecution, you know, people striking back against me, I always thought that they were persecuting me because of God. And I realized it wasn't Jesus or God thinks they were persecuting. It was that I was being a jerk. Aggressive and abrasive. And, you know, I want to go back to something that I said a few weeks ago. One of my favorite verses is found in the fourth chapter of Philippians, and it says, let your gentleness be evident always. And I feel like that's, fortunately, I've shifted away from some of those things. And God's really done something in my heart. And I want to live by that verse. So let my gentleness be evident always. And if I get persecuted for doing that, I'll take that one for the team.
Yeah. Man, that's good. That's heavy. We should start like a list of all the good that Christian swears. I'm sure that exists on the internet. You know what I'm saying? Darn. Well, frick. No, seriously. Sorry. He got all serious and then I was stuck back in there. Honestly, I think, you know, what he's saying about the gentleness and heart and the spirit, I think that makes me think that, like, looking through the Beatitudes and reading them is a good place for us to start. And I said about us doing a heart check, right? A heart check on ourselves, on our attitude toward people. And if you seek to be a peacemaker, and if you seek to be someone who, you know what, if you're going to be persecuted, to be persecuted for the right things, do that heart check. And, you know, is your persecution coming because you're living out of a contrite heart and a humbled spirit? Go back to that first beatitude, you remember? Blessed are the poor in spirit. Is that where your persecution's coming from? Is your persecution coming because you desire to bring peace and beauty and love into the world and to bring something really good and redemptive into the world around you? Or is your persecution coming because you're self-righteous and you need an ego check. You've got an axe to grind. Let God speak to you on that. I'm not here to judge. I'm asking, let's do this together. Let's bring ourselves before God. That's why I feel like it's so vitally important for us to be connected in His Spirit to God, to have Him speak to us on these matters. Okay? And as we develop that, as we become these people who are bringing peace and expecting, fully expecting and willing to go to the places that we are going to get persecuted, we're going to see some amazing things happen, And Jamie, man, he's got, you know, you've had some incredible stories of some of this, you and Edwina, so maybe you could share a little bit.
You know, Edwina and I have been married for 15 years, and Edwina and I really love spending time with people. And more than that, we love spending time with people from different cultures. It's something that we really value. And one of the things that I really fell in love with Edwina was her values. Little history on that is Edwina was raised by her grandmother. And her grandmother had such a great impact on her life. Such a great impact. Her grandma taught her the value of people. Taught her the value of loving people. In its truest essence, her grandmother taught her to not judge a person truly by the color of their skin, but to really judge them by the content of their character. Her grandma taught her that. Her grandma modeled for her a spirit of inclusiveness to all different types of people. Edwina was raised about that from the spirit of her grandmother, was always being inclusive with people and reaching across culture lines and reaching across, you know, whether it was the bad neighbor, the good neighbor, you know, the neighborhood is where she modeled this essence of inclusiveness and loving people. And I wasn't necessarily raised like that, but when I did come into church when I was 20 and I came to know Christ in African-American church in Minneapolis, one of my first real mentors, I never had any real mentors early in my life, but Sister Maxine from this church really had a powerful influence on my life. And when I used to carry around a briefcase and this big Bible, and I don't know why I always carried around a big Bible and a briefcase, but I did. Adam Mock is actually trying to find a briefcase and a big Bible to go along with me. But I had this big Bible, and I had all these notes that Sister Maxine used to sit me down, because she beelined me all the time when I walk into church. She would come and just sit down and ask me how I was doing, and she would just say things, and I remember always writing it down. And one of the things that she said to me, she embodied this. She said, "Jamie, despite the racial divide that we have in America, despite that," she goes, "I love people from all walks of life. Black people, white people, it doesn't matter to me." She goes, "I will always, always be intentional about reaching across cultural lines." And she'd always tell me the story about a story she heard about Diane Sawyer interviewing Billy Graham. And Diane Sawyer had asked Billy Graham and said, "Billy, you've been around the world. You've met presidents. You've observed our society. You've ministered unto our society for years." And Diane Sawyer had asked Billy Graham, "Billy, if you could wipe away one thing in the world, what would you wipe away?" And without a hesitancy, Billy Graham said, "Racial strife and division." But Sister Maxine, she modeled that for me. The people of that community at Trinity Tabernacle modeled that for me. Valuing loving people, loving others, being inclusive, being one of the only white men in that church, but being treated like a child of God from beginning to end. That was the spirit in which I was taught, that spirit of a reconcile, that spirit of a peacemaker. And it's no wonder that here God put Edwina and I together when we met at Bible college, put two people with that same type of passion for peacemaker, that same type of passion for the ministry of reconciliation, treating other people with dignity and respect, no matter what culture they came from. So Edwina and I got married in 97, and we're still going to our undergrad stuff at that time, and it was amazing walking around married in that Bible college, because it was amazing to hear and see the nonverbals and the verbals that were given to us, that with the attitude of why is this white man with this black woman? Why is this white man with this black woman? Why is this black woman with this white man? And it wasn't just about that she was a sweet, sexy mama, okay? It wasn't like going, well, you married to her? She married down, man. You married up. It wasn't those kind of looks, because I know those kind of looks when someone's checking her out. I go, what's she checking out, man? That guy's checking her out. It wasn't that kind of look where we get those looks. But it was the looks, it was the frowns. And it wasn't just nonverbal, it was the verbals. And it wasn't just in that Bible college. And it certainly wasn't everybody in that Bible college. But it was some professors. It was students. And it wasn't just in it was in the churches too. We and I served at church in First Covenant Church. It was the same. As a matter of fact, one of my pastor who married us was honest with us. And when he married us, he said he had a conversation with the sheriff of St. Paul and says, I wasn't sure, Jamie, if the church was really going to come out and support you guys. Yeah. He goes, he was being honest with me years later. He goes, we weren't sure. But it wasn't just in the church circles. I mean, it's going to the Mall of America. It's seeing people say things. It's walking into a restaurant. And you're wondering, are you being, is the quality of service, the poor service, is it because they're having a bad day? Or is it because we're an interracial couple? When you go into clothing stores, it's different if it happened once or twice. But we and I have stories of that on a monthly basis. When you walk into a clothing store and you walk in and you see other people walk in after you that get served, and you're sitting here still wondering, when's someone going to come and ask me and ask us, can I help you? It's stories like that. It's stories like that that can bring tension to this ministry of a peacemaker, this ministry of reconciliation. It's those type of stories. Family members not necessarily agreeing with it. People saying and being confrontational at times even. What are you doing with him? What are you doing with her? What are you doing? That type of persecution. But I'm here to tell you from the bottom of my heart, the bottom of my heart, we have resolve. We have resolved. Edwina and I are committed to the ministry of reconciliation. We will go into schools, we will go into churches, we will go and we will represent, yes, black people and white people can truly not judge each other by the color of their skins. But I can look into my wife's heart, she can look into my heart and see a man and I can see a woman. And yes, it's exactly what Jesus is talking about. And that resolve, and despite the persecution, despite the opposition, we're committed. Because having the blessing to be a peacemaker far outweighs any persecution. It's the blessing of a peacemaker. That's why Jesus can proclaim, blessed are the peacemakers, for they will be sons and daughters of God. That's why he can proclaim that. There's a blessing to the peacemaker. And so here we are at the end of this series. And Jesus painted a wonderful picture for us of what type of person he truly wants us to be. And he described our calling, each of us, our calling as our role as being poor in spirit, as being mourning, gentle and meek, hungering and thirsting for righteousness, being merciful, pure of heart, a peacemaker. And yes, like even Ben described, even being persecuted. But what would happen if we were to take these Beatitudes and we were to take each one of them and apply them into our life slowly? What would happen? Imagine for a moment you as a parent that you care so much about having peace and blessing in your home, you're willing to leave work early every day and make it a habit. You're so concerned about having peace and blessing in your home that you come home early, and instead of being tired and wore out and a little bit of critical because you're tired, but instead you leave home early and you come in the door and you spend time blessing your family. having dinner with them, learning how to pray with your children again, learning how to play with your children again. Do you imagine if you were to make that type of shift because you were so concerned about peace and blessing? Do you imagine what that would do to your home? Well, imagine in your marriages, if you were so concerned about peace and blessing that you're more concerned about feeding in the desires of your spouse and meeting their needs over your own. Do you imagine if you were to make that fundamental shift and you were so concerned about bringing peace and blessing to your spouse over your own needs? What would that happen? What shift would that happen in your marriage dynamic? What would happen? And imagine for a moment in your workplace, instead you start watching your tongues in the workplace, and you're so concerned about peace and blessing and healing, and you're less concerned about gossip. Do you imagine what that would do if you spent time praying for that coworker who frustrates the heck out of you, and you start to have a spirit of peace and blessing to that coworker? Do you imagine what that would do if you just spent 5 minutes praying for them before you walked in the doorway? What would happen in your workplace? Well, multiply this. What about as an Orchard community that we started to hear stories on a consistent basis about people being persecuted, but for the right reasons? Do you imagine you started to hear stories about persecution for the right reasons, and it was for the right reasons because of mercy and blessing and peace and love and compassion? Stories of persecution, but it was because the right reasons that you were giving peace and blessing in your families, your communities, your city. Yeah, we hear stories about being reviled, but it's for the right reasons. And do you imagine, for every story of persecution, there was a story of life change that came with it? Because you were so concerned about being humble before God, hungering and thirsting for righteousness, giving mercy to others, bringing peace, and despite the opposition, God was using you to help change another life. Do you imagine that? To have stories like that? Stories of persecution, but side with that, stories of life change and blessings and peace. Because the power and blessing of a peacemaker far outweighs the persecution. Imagine that for a moment.
I'm going to ask you just to close your eyes. And we're going to wrap this series the same way that we started. And I'm going to ask you just to take your anything that's in your hands and set it down, and just to take your hands and turn them face up, your palms facing up. 6 weeks ago, we started a journey where we were invited to become poor in spirit, to pour our lives out before God and to say, God, it's not my life anymore, it's yours. And yes, there's mourning with that. There's grieving the loss of some of what we dreamed of, but it's so beautiful and freeing. And through that humility and through that emptiness, God fills us up. And I want you to just imagine your hands as empty vessels that you have given up to him. And maybe you haven't taken that step yet. Use this moment to just confess to God that you desire to give him your life and to let him do with it as he will. God, it's our desire as the people of God, as this local community called the Orchard, and as followers of Jesus, that our hands would be open for you, that we'd be poor in spirit, that we would really open our lives up to whatever it is that you want to do with us. And we recognize, God, that that's painful at times, but it's a beautiful story. Help us to embrace that. I want you just to open your eyes and to look into those hands. We as a community believe that God is in the ministry and the work of reconciliation. and of restoration. And I want you to look at your hands and realize that it's through the hands and feet of those committed to Jesus that he works even today. Would you look at your hands and would you proclaim to God, these hands are your hands. Do with them as you will. Make us the hands and feet of you, Jesus. Let us walk out your mission on this earth and love people radically. And we know there will be people who don't like that, but we're going to do it anyway. We're committing our lives and our hands to be used by you. And we wrap that and this series up in the name of Jesus and his community, we said. Amen.
Amen.